Hello, this is Bare Naked Politics. This is a podcast for people who would like very much to keep up with the headlines, but who don't profess to be any kind of politics wizard. So if you just want someone to strip back the headlines and explain what's going on in normal speak, I can do that for you. And my gosh, is there so much to talk about today. I'm Julia Bell, and I think I've got about four or five podcasts worth of stuff to talk to you about. So it's going to be a really good one for you to listen to all the way through, because it'll just be a nice succinct summary of what's happening in the world. If you are living in England, then I'm sure you've had it penciled into your diary for some time now, but the 17th of May, we've been thinking for a while that might be the day that the world opens up a bit. We can eat inside a pub or a restaurant. Imagine the liberty, just as the weather's getting warmer, we can eat inside. We can go inside other people's houses. Another liberty that we haven't had for over a year. You can hug your loved ones, take a trip abroad. These are things that I personally have been dying to do. Well, I tell you what, if you've got it in pencil, you can now trace it with pen. It's happening. 17th of May, we're moving to the next stage of Boris Johnson's roadmap to normality, as he keeps calling it. On the hugging aspect, it's just very weird to hear the Prime Minister talk about hugging at all, but in that Downing Street £2.6 million press conference room with Union Jack flags either side of him. I'm sure that most of you think that press conference room was an excellent investment. But there he was, talking about hugging in it. And even though it's surreal, that's been the big question, hasn't it? You know, when can I hug my parents? When can I, if I meet someone for a coffee, not have to do this weird elbow bump thing anymore? It's just such a big part of our lives that I don't think any of us really realised until it was taken away, that touching other people appropriately, is something that we do every day and that we kind of need. So he, of course, had to address it. And this is what he said on the 10th of May, all about that topic.
And today we're taking a step towards that moment when we learn to live responsibly with COVID, when we cease eventually to rely on detailed government edicts and make our own decisions based on the best scientific advice about how to protect our families and those around us. So from next Monday, we're updating the guidance on close contact between friends and family, setting out the risks for everyone to make their own choices. This doesn't mean we can suddenly throw caution to the winds. In fact, more than a year into this pandemic, we all know that close contact, such as hugging, is a direct way of transmitting this disease. So I urge you to think about the vulnerability of your loved ones, whether they've had a vaccine, one or two doses, and whether there has been time for that vaccine to take effect.
So that was Boris Johnson on the 10th of May. I told you it was weird. It's just weird hearing the Prime Minister talk about hugging, but that was him saying, yes, you can. Obviously, from the 17th of May, we'll have these different groupings. So you're allowed to meet up to 30 in a group of up to 30 outside, or you're allowed to be in a group of up to 6 inside. And within that group, hug away if you want to, but you have to use your common sense. We'll come back to that press briefing in a bit, because he laid out all sorts of things that will be opening up: restaurants, pubs, cinemas, university lectures, and so on. But the overall tone was very optimistic. And to hear from his mouth that it's going to be much less about the government actually telling us what to do and much more about us, the public, exercising our own decision-making faculties, that I think is going to be the next theme in the months to come from the government. If the COVID rates keep going down at the way that they're doing, they're going to put a bit more onus onto us, the public, to start using our common sense, basically. And it sounds really patronising, but basically for the past year, we've not been allowed. It's not even that we've had the choice to use our common sense. It's that the government has told us what is and isn't legal in terms of meeting and touching and going inside and all the rest of it. So weirdly, I think that the government will start to give us some autonomy back in the coming months. And remember, Boris Johnson likes to paint himself as a libertarian. You might not agree with him doing that, since the government has been talking a lot recently about putting more police on the streets. And, you know, there's this bill that's going to tighten up our rights to have peaceful protests. But Boris Johnson himself would definitely describe himself that way. And libertarians are all about laissez-faire politics, let the public do what they want to do, don't have too much government intervention. The perfect world would be a place where you can't really feel the government at all. That's the philosophy. And in many respects, Boris Johnson has had to become Mr. What's the opposite of libertarian? Mr. Authoritarian, telling us that we have to stay home, you know, not even letting people go to their own family members' funerals, essentially creating a world where the government is breathing down our necks inside our homes every day. So being a self-professed libertarian in charge at a time of a pandemic, I think throughout this last year and a half, there will have been a lot of sort of inner battles for Boris Johnson. And I can imagine no one will have enjoyed hearing those words, you can start to make decisions on your own, hearing those words more than Boris Johnson himself. Anyway, what a tangent that was. Today, I want to give you some details about what we can do in England from the 17th of May, but I won't dwell on that because I know lots of you aren't actually English residents. Then I want to talk about what the rules on holidays will be. Again, won't dwell because I know that it's not the same for everybody. I want to talk about the Queen's speech on Tuesday, the 11th of May, and tell you what happened and why and what it means. And then finally, and this is interesting for everybody, I think, I want to give you a bit of commentary about the results from the multiple different elections that we had across England, Scotland and Wales. So we'll talk about the actual results themselves, why they've got the Labour Party in a bit of a kerfuffle, what Nicola Sturgeon's planning to do about Scottish independence and how receptive Westminster are going to be about that. I'll give you a clue, not receptive. There's a lot of different things to bite off today, so make sure you're subscribed or that you've clicked follow if you're listening on Spotify so you never miss future episodes. And without further ado, let's start hacking away at this kind of Goliath of a week. Okay, first things first, just to get it out of the way, what exactly are we going to be allowed to do in England from the 17th of May? The rules will differ slightly in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland because they have devolved parliaments to handle that. But here's what Boris Johnson said at the 10th of May press briefing about these new rules in England coming in from Monday.
I can confirm today that we've met our four tests for further easing the lockdown in England. And the data now support moving to step three in England from next Monday, the 17th of May. This means the rule of six or two households that is applied outdoors will now apply indoors. And the limit for outdoor meetings will increase to 30. From next Monday, you'll be able to sit inside a pub and inside a restaurant. You'll be able to go to the cinema and children will be able to use indoor play areas. We're reopening hostels, hotels, B&Bs. We'll reopen the doors to our theatres, concert halls and business conference centres. We'll unlock the turnstiles of our sports stadia subject to capacity limits. And from next week, everyone will be able to travel within Britain and stay overnight.
There you go. And if you want full details, just type into Google 17th of May gov.uk and that'll take you to the government webpage. It's better to just go straight to the horse's mouth and get it direct from the government rather than from Facebook or whatever. It's never the best way to go. And that will just take you directly to that webpage. What is your first indoor pub drink going to be? That's the most important question. It will be the first... Hang on, will it? Yeah, be the first indoor pub drink of 2021. Gosh, it's the middle of May and this will be our first indoor drink. This is an important decision. Get in touch with me on social media at @JuliaBell_X. I would usually go for a massive rosé, but since this is a special occasion, I might have to get some sort of obscene cocktail that's over the £10 mark. I might go hard and we can go to the cinema. I haven't been to the cinema since the beginning of last year, if that. So please get in touch with me. Tell me what you're doing. Tell me how you're marking the occasion. Are you going to brave a holiday? I want to hear about it. And actually, that's what we'll talk about next. Okay, so holidays. I had got to a point, to be honest, where I just thought, right, I'm going to be living out my days, the rest of my days, on this relatively limited spit of land that is the British Isles. But here we are, the government have released a traffic light system where there's lists of countries, green, amber and red, and Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary on Boris Johnson's cabinet, He stood up on that podium and introduced what that all means on Wednesday, the 7th of May. Let's hear from him before we unpack it.
Red countries are those which should not be visited except in the most extreme of circumstances, where repeated testing and isolation in designated government hotels on return is compulsory. Non-UK residents who've been in a red country in the last 10 days will still be barred from entering the UK. Amber countries form the biggest group. As with the red list, you should not be travelling to these places right now. Returnees will have to do tests on three separate occasions, once before departure, twice after arrival, and isolate in a place of their choosing for 10 days. Finally, we have the green countries, which you will have the opportunity to visit no earlier than the 17th of May. And with these green countries, you will not need to quarantine. So I'm announcing today that from May the 17th, you'll be able to travel to 12 green list countries and territories, which includes Portugal, Gibraltar, and Israel. I regret the favourite summer destinations like France and Spain and Greece are not yet included, but every 3 weeks from reopening, we'll be reviewing the countries to see how and where we can expand the green list.
So there you go. Grant Shapps, the Transport Secretary, outlining the meaning of these green, amber and red lists to be reviewed every 3 weeks. So I anticipate that we will see that green list grow, hopefully, because there's only 12 countries on it and some of them you'd have to be extremely wealthy to even work out how you get there. They're so far away and they're so random. But you might see, I think, in the future, the odd place sort of hop back to amber or even red if they experience outbreaks. So Shapps has sort of left the door open on both ends for that eventuality. And what is on that green list, I hear you say? I haven't actually mentioned that yet, have I? Get ready to hear the most random assortment of places you've ever heard in one breath. Let me get them up, hang on. Australia, Brunei, Falkland Islands, Faroe Islands, Gibraltar, Iceland, Israel and Jerusalem, New Zealand, Portugal, Singapore, South Georgia and South Sandwich Islands, St Helena, Ascension and Tristan da Cunha. So you can go there from Monday 17th of May. I'm not sure what last minute flights are like to the Falkland Islands. Considering it is down by Argentina, I imagine relatively expensive, if not non-existent. But there you go. Those are the ones that you're allowed to go to for now. The thing is, though, whether all of those destinations will accept us as visitors is a different story. As far as I'm aware, the likes of New Zealand, which are very firmly on the green list, have absolutely no interest in tourists from the UK stepping anywhere near their incredibly COVID-free turf. They've done an amazing job this last year of keeping COVID cases in the single digits. So it's a bit of an audacious list in that way, but I have seen a few people already say that they're booking trips to Portugal. So if you are desperate for a holiday that is within a reasonable budget, it is doable as long as the place you're going to is happy to accept you when you get there. Do check that, I would say, before booking. And it is a step forward, isn't it? To be able to go on holiday again feels like something that, you know, is from the old world, the old pre-COVID world. But for a lot of people within the travel industry, they're saying this is nowhere near a big enough step. So a couple of examples. Andrew Flintham, the managing director of TUI, you know, T-U-I, the holiday firm, he said, quote, "While we were expecting to see just a handful of destinations on the green list, this is an overly cautious start." And Shapps has also had criticism from the EasyJet chief executive. He said, quote, "The decision to put so few European countries on the green list here is simply not justified by the data or the science and is inconsistent with the approach to reopen the domestic economy." I'm interested to see that kind of push and pull in the coming weeks. And then, of course, you've got to think about the destinations themselves, places like Greece and Spain, whose travel economies really enjoy Brits. We're a great source of income for them and probably a really big chunk of the overall amount of cash that they bring in, and they'll be really struggling without us. So I imagine that they will be watching these lists and hankering after the day that we can hastily return to getting our shit tattoos and get arrested for climbing over bars and things. Aren't we great? Okay, Queen's speech now. Let's talk about this. So I've had a few questions from folks on Instagram just asking why? Why does the Queen do a speech? What's it for? And what's the point? Basically, it's a ceremonial situation and it marks a time where the Parliament resets. Parliament, you can think of it, to be honest, just like school. A school year, in England at least, works its way through until the summer months and then it breaks for the summer and then everyone picks up and starts again in September. So a school year starts in September. A parliamentary year usually starts in spring. Now, not every Prime Minister conforms to the way that it's typically done. Theresa May, for example, she put off, ending one parliamentary session and beginning another one because she was in the midst of an absolute mess with Brexit. So her philosophy was, let's carry on through this and then maybe we can do a Queen's speech and all the rest of it later when we've got this sorted. So that's kind of what Theresa May did. And then Boris Johnson, he's probably the most famous example of someone who has not necessarily played by the rules of ending parliamentary sessions and starting new ones because he famously prorogued Parliament in 2019. So when he basically, at a time that PMs don't usually do this, sent everyone away. It would be like your headmaster at school rocking up in like, I don't know, January and saying, summer is here. Goodbye, you must all leave now. Like, that's kind of a shocking thing to do. And that's what Boris Johnson did in 2019. He prorogued Parliament and then the Queen did a speech to mark a new session. And that was incredibly controversial. I don't know if you remember, but all the MPs, basically, who weren't in Boris Johnson's camp were completely kicking off, absolutely furious, because they thought he was just doing this so that they were sent away and he could push through his agenda with Brexit without getting any pushback from the opposition. So it was a huge controversy. It ended up going through to the Supreme Court, who decided that Boris Johnson had broken the law. I think the term they used was that he'd acted unlawfully. Anyway, bottom line, the Queen makes a speech to start a new parliamentary session. And there's this whole procession, usually, where she sits in this sort of horse and carriage and she's driven along to Westminster. And then she gets out and she sits on a throne in the House of Lords and they present her with this crown that's on a kind of velvety cushion. But this time, because of COVID restrictions, there wasn't a horse and carriage. She was driven there in a car. And if you see pictures from the event in the House of Lords, it was pretty spaced out with everyone and lots of people wearing masks and all the rest of it. So what actually happens for this Queen's speech is the government writes out a bullet point list, basically of all the things that they're aiming to achieve in the upcoming parliamentary session. So the Queen sits with, it's like a little booklet with big writing, and she reads out this sort of bullet point list of all the goals. She does not have any input in writing it herself, because that would mean that she would have a say over what our politicians do. And that is precisely the opposite of what she's allowed to do. She's not meant to have any say at all. So it's totally a figurehead thing where she reads it out. But even if she doesn't agree with what she's reading out, it doesn't matter. And to be honest, we would never know that because she's not meant to share how she feels about any sort of political situation. So she sits and reads it out. And since she's the head of state, technically, in the UK, she talks about it as if it's her government doing these things for her people. Have a listen.
My government's priority is to deliver a national recovery from the pandemic that makes the United Kingdom stronger, healthier, and more prosperous than before. To achieve this, my government will level up opportunities across all parts of the United Kingdom, supporting jobs, businesses, and economic growth, and addressing the impact of the pandemic on public services.
So that was the Queen addressing the House of Lords on the morning of the Tuesday, the 11th of May. Nothing she said, to be honest, was overly surprising because a lot of it was already stuff that the government have been working towards in the last parliamentary session. For instance, the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, very, very controversial bill that I did a whole episode on back in March. And if you haven't listened to that, I highly recommend it because it's a really important bit of legislation. It's really divisive. And I think, you know, it'll be annoying if you feel a bit left out because it'll be a big conversation over the next few months. Let me find out what that episode was called. It was called Can They Stop Us Protesting? And that episode, it's number 19, is all about that bill. The Queen also talked about levelling up. And if you've listened to this podcast over the last few episodes, you'll have heard me talking about that because that is Boris Johnson's slogan of the hour. Level up. We've got to level up the country. And it's this idea that the government wants to put an end to regional inequality. So let's not have, you know, haves in the southeast and have-nots in the north. Let's try and invest in areas that have been neglected, like northern towns. Let's put money into this high-speed rail, which would connect the north to the south and would cover areas like Manchester. So she talked about levelling up, and it was kind of weird in a way to hear the Queen use Boris Johnson's jargon. She mentioned a particularly controversial thing again called the Electoral Integrity Bill. The Electoral Integrity Bill, which is basically going to introduce being ID'd when you want to vote in general elections. So at the moment, if you've voted, you'll know that you can just rock up. You don't even need to bring your polling card. And as long as you say your name and your name checks out that you've registered, then you can go ahead and vote. And some people have said, that seems a bit insecure. Surely we should prove that we are who we say we are. So the government have said, you know what? Yeah, let's bring this in. However, I have to say, it's interesting that they are so worried about voter fraud, which is what it is if you pretend to be someone else and vote on their behalf. It's a bit odd that they're worried about it because it just doesn't really happen. It's not that big a deal in the UK. I think, you know, the amount of electoral fraud that we had in the last general election was double digits, if that. I think it was like 33 allegations of people pretending to be other people in the polling booths in 2019. So to bring in a whole bill to prevent something so irregular is quite something. But you might think, well, it's the principle of the thing. We should introduce a bill that, you know, protects the integrity and the security of our democracy, even if it's not massively under threat at this time. But some people are looking at it like, why are we bothering with this? Plus, it's a total infringement. It creates an environment where the government are suspicious of its own public. And other people have said, well, this just adds a layer of bureaucracy. People are already a little bit put off by voting. We don't have the world's best turnout figures in the UK as it is. If you're telling people that they have to prove their identity before they can even get in, you're going to put people off, especially people who don't have ID. But then the government have come back. I mean, this is a conversation. I'm basically giving you all sides to it. But the government have come back and said, well, don't worry. We're not going to expect people to have driver's license. They can apply for a free kind of paper document that acts as an ID that they can use to vote. But then the critics of that are saying, yeah, that kind of sounds like they're going to need access to the internet, and not everyone does. So you're massively kind of suppressing marginalised people. And the biggest cynics of Boris Johnson have said, I know why you're doing this, because the people who don't have access to driver's licences and the people who don't have access to the internet are probably people who would vote Labour. So are you intentionally suppressing people who wouldn't naturally support the Conservative Party? Obviously, Boris Johnson has denied that entirely and said, no way, this is just about the security of the voting system. Up to you to decide how you feel about that debate. I actually think it's a really interesting debate. So if you've got really, really strong views, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a message on social media at @JuliaBell_X. And that's just one element. So you can imagine how much she actually covered, you know, housing, the pandemic recovery. She talked about broadening the coverage of 5G. I always think it's really weird to hear the Queen talk about tech. I don't know why. Because she's sitting in this very old school throne, covered in jewels. You know, usually she's brought there by horse and carriage, and then she sits there talking about broadband. It's just a bit odd. And listen, I would actually recommend watching it if you've never before, because it's not that long, 10, 12 minutes long. And it gives you a bit of a humbling reminder of how weird the customs in the UK actually are. And it's one of those things, it's just always been this way, so we've not bothered to change it. But as a modern everyday person, if you just watch it, having never seen it before, you think, what the hell? What is going on? And one of the traditions that I'll actually just quickly mention that is particularly odd, and it happened on the Tuesday, the 11th of May, same as always, is where when the Queen is seated and the ceremony is about to start, a sort of senior officer within the House of Lords, known as Black Rod, is dressed all in black with a literal black, big black rod. I wish I was joking. They walk from the House of Lords physically across the lobby towards the House of Commons. And then as Black Rod comes forth, the members of the House of Commons are meant to slam the door in their face. And that, so they're there shouting, close the door, and the door slams with Black Rod standing just outside. It's so odd. And it's meant to signify how the House of Commons is full of common folk. It's full of directly elected people that the public have put there who are therefore free from the shackles of the monarchy's control. And the point is, you know, this is Black Rod coming to summon us, but we don't have to come if we don't want to. So we'll slam the door in your face. But then this Black Rod person bangs the door 3 times and then the door opens again. So it's just symbolic because a Black Rod actually has a purpose, because then they walk in. This time it was a woman. So she came in and summoned the MPs through to the House of Lords because, you know, it's time for the Queen's speech. So come through and watch it. And then they all get up and follow. It's so odd. So they slam the door in their face and then they say, oh, sorry, come on in. Like, what? But it's all symbolic. So I'll link a video in the episode description that includes that so you can watch all the ceremonial stuff if you want to have a look. Right, now you're all caught up with Westminster stuff, everything from hugs to black rods. Let's look at all the other tiers of governance in the UK. So we've got, you know, parliaments in Scotland and Wales, we've got the councils, we've got the mayoralties. They have all been experiencing a bit of a shake-up this week. Should we just run through the results, first of all? Starting on a local level, obviously we had local council elections taking place across England exclusively. And you probably heard by now that it was an excellent day for the Conservative Party and a beyond tragic day for Labour in terms of the local council stuff. So think of councils like mini parliaments because they have seats. And then if a party gets a majority of those seats, then they get to run the council. So across England, the Conservatives gained 294 seats, taking them to a total of 2,346 various council seats across the country. That's good going. To gain 294 seats, i.e. seats that were not Conservative but are now, it's a really nice thing for them. And often, the party that's running the government doesn't do that in local elections, because people use this as an excuse to show what they're unhappy with about the government. So people quite often vote for opposition parties or smaller parties because they're sick of the current government, and this is their excuse to feel empowered to escape that, even though this doesn't actually affect Westminster. So usually you see a bit of a pushback against the incumbent party, but that did not happen here. Obviously Boris Johnson is really popular in England. I think that's what we can take from this, or one thing that we can anyway. And I would pin a lot of that to the vaccine rollout, or the success of it anyway. The fact that COVID cases are absolutely plummeting, and COVID deaths, and the fact that we can start resuming little elements of the old life. I think that the timing of this election with that has been great for the Conservatives and for Boris Johnson's profile. And another thing that we can take away is that Labour are struggling. And I did do a whole episode on that the other day called Are Labour Dying? But their performance in the local elections certainly doesn't stop people from asking that question, because they lost 264 seats overall. Not good to lose that many seats. And there used to be 44 Labour-run councils up and down England that were run by them. It's gone down to 36. So they've lost control of certain councils, as well as literally hundreds of seats up and down the country. The Lib Dems had an okay day. They gained 3 seats. So they now have a total of 588 seats across the country. Not great, but not terrible. Sort of stayed put. And then the Greens. The Greens are having a really big moment, I think. They gained 85 seats. So they've got a total of 151. But I think these votes not affecting Westminster means that people feel empowered to vote like how they really feel. And I think you speak to a lot of people, I speak to a lot of young people particularly, who really like the Greens, but they don't vote for them in general elections because they don't feel like they've got a real chance of getting in. But this is their opportunity to go, well, let's try them out on a council level and let's see. And I think a lot of people, and this is a really bad thing, I suppose, but a lot of people don't really know what the council does. So they think, well, fuck it, I'll vote Green. I don't know how much that'll affect me. By the way, it does massively affect you, but I think people do kind of not throw their votes, but they just experiment a bit more. They feel a bit more free to do that. So I think that might have been an element here. You can let me know if you agree. And then I think also just the fact that environmental concerns are looming and people, I think, are hoping to take that more seriously. And I reckon a bump in support for the Greens is a sign that people in the UK are worried and concerned and would like to prioritise that issue. So I hope that the national government run by Boris Johnson takes note of that for sure. Oh, I had a question from one of you on the local elections before we move on. Katie asked, are local elections a good predictor of national election outcomes? Yeah, some people say that. Some people say this gives you an idea of how people would vote if there was a general election tomorrow. I think that you can't avoid it. You can't avoid looking at it as a bit of a pulse check. You know, how is everyone doing? Are you happy with the government? Let's give you this local elections vote and watch what you say. But it's a bit more complicated than that because they're different roles, completely different roles. They are unrelated in many ways. And I, like I said before, people vote a bit differently. People vote Green, people vote Lib Dem. And then when it gets to general elections, a lot of people are a bit worried to do that. So they just stick to Tories and Labour. Right or wrong, you can decide how you feel about that. But I don't know if it's that good an indicator of how a general election would go. What I will tell you is, I think this tells us that the Tories would win again if we had a general election tomorrow. But it's a great question, and I think, yeah, view it as a pulse check. Anyway, that's local stuff. Then there were mayoral elections. I explained what directly elected mayors do and what they are a couple of episodes ago. It was an episode called Local Elections, Why Bother? So no need to go into that again today, but results-wise, Labour had a better go at this. I think they'll be a bit happier with this performance, especially because they nicked a couple of mayoralties from the Tories. So the Labour candidate managed to nick the role off of the Conservative in the West of England. They had a Tory mayor, now they have a Labour one. It happened the same in Cambridgeshire. So it used to be a Tory, but the Labour candidate nicked it. Also, West Yorkshire, they'd never had a mayor before. This was the first election for that. And the Labour candidate, Tracy Brabin, won that as well. So Labour have done okay. And then other than that, I think the theme has been a lot more about if you already had the role, chances are you got it back. I think the people who already had it were mostly re-elected. So Sadiq Khan of London, who's obviously the Labour mayor, he was re-elected. Andy Burnham of Manchester, Labour incumbent, very famous Labour incumbent. I think most people know who Andy Burnham is because he challenged the government so much throughout the pandemic on behalf of Manchester, trying to get Manchester people, you know, more stuff, more money. And sort of saying that the government was neglecting Manchester. He got his role back with 70% of the vote, well, 69 point something. So I think there's an element of if you're visible and if people know who you are and if you look busy, if you look like you're doing stuff, people will vote for you, even if they didn't actually always vote for that party. I think that's what happened with Andy Burnham, is quite a few Tories will have voted for him because they thought, this guy really cares about Manchester and we've watched that this year, so let's just get him back in. And again, that's why we can't always use this as a blueprint for what happens on a general election. And then on the Tory front, the same pattern of usually if you already had the role, you got voted back in. So that was the case for Andy Street, the Tory mayor of West Midlands, and Ben Houchen, I think I'm saying his name wrong, the Tory mayor of the Tees Valley. They both got big boosts as well. So I think it's this idea of, you know, they had okay support before, but they've been really visible during the pandemic. People know who they are. They see their name on the ballot. They vote for them again. Do you know what I mean? So that's the mayors. But turning our eyes to the Welsh parliamentary election now, aka the Senedd, that's the name of the Welsh Parliament. It was a Labour majority before, it is a Labour majority again. So the Labour leader, Mark Drakeford, gets his role back as the First Minister of Wales. Quite odd, considering the Tories absolutely swept up in England and yet the Labour Party held quite successfully on to Wales. So what's going on here? There's a bit of a disparity between England and Wales, and I think that will make Boris Johnson panic a little bit. Like, oh, okay, our neighbours pretty much on every side don't support the Tories. I need to get that support outside of England. I can't just be the leader of England. I need to be the leader of the UK. So if nobody else likes me outside of England, I'm in trouble. I think that's something that he will be thinking about. But could this be another one of those themes that if you already had the job during the pandemic, you got to get it back? And people just thought, let's give this person the job back, because the worst thing right now would be a changeover, a handover of power, because that would create, you know, unrest. And we don't need that right now, coming off the back of a pandemic. It's been a rough year. Let's just get through this with the people who have been in charge the whole way through. Now let's look at Scotland. There's 129 seats that were up for grabs in Holyrood, which is the name of the Scottish Parliament. And the Scottish National Party got 64 of those, which is one more than what they had. But it's still not an overall outright majority, because you need more than half. And 64 is not more than half of 129. In terms of the rest of the breakdown, the Conservatives got 31, Labour got 22, the Greens got 8, which is something. I think that's actually amazing for them. I sound so biased towards the Greens. It's not that. I'm just quite shocked to be talking about them so much, because they're usually seen as like a bit of a niche party. But they're on the up, and this election is really showing that, I think. So the Greens got 8 and the Lib Dems got 4. Put it this way, we had a Liberal Democrat government in 2010. We had a coalition between the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. And now the Lib Dems are fighting for the same amount of seats as the Greens. And the other reason that I'm reading so much about the Greens is because they actually play a very important role in Scottish politics right now, because the Greens support independence in Scotland. So when it comes to breaking away from the UK, they've actually got the same agenda pretty much as the SNP. So the Conservatives are looking at this Scottish election result and saying, ha, Nicola Sturgeon, you didn't get a majority, so independence shouldn't be a conversation. We're not talking to you about this. But Nicola Sturgeon's saying, yeah, but if you add the SNP numbers with the Greens numbers, then that is a comfy majority. So that surely means that more than half of the Scottish people want independence. So that is still a conversation that I want to have. And that was something that she was very quick to mention in that speech on the 6th of May.
The people of Scotland have voted to give pro-independence parties a majority in the Scottish Parliament. Both the SNP and the Scottish Greens stood on a clear commitment to an independence referendum within the next parliamentary term. It is the will of the country. And given that outcome, there is simply no democratic justification whatsoever for Boris Johnson, or indeed for anyone else, seeking to block the right of the people of Scotland to choose our own future. If the Tories make such an attempt, they won't be placing themselves in opposition to the SNP. They will be standing in direct opposition to the will of the Scottish people. And they will demonstrate conclusively that the UK is not a partnership of equals, and astonishingly, that Westminster no longer sees it as a voluntary union of nations. That in itself would be a most powerful argument for Scotland becoming an independent country.
I've thought about that speech a lot since she did it, and I've heard it through 4 or 5 times now, and I just think the wording of it is definitely worth taking note of. Did you hear the bit where Nicola Sturgeon talked about the will of the Scottish people? Well, who used that phrase, the will of the people, the most during Brexit? Boris Johnson. So she's using his expression against him, because he was, you know, when he was trying to get Brexit done, as he would say, and he was making all these crazy moves to try and sort that, including proroguing Parliament and all the rest of it. He would say, but I'm trying to execute the will of the people, which is to get Brexit done. I have no doubt that there is no coincidence in the fact that Nicola Sturgeon is using it now and basically trying to put Boris Johnson in a corner and saying, you can't be a Democrat for the stuff that interests you, but an anti-Democrat for stuff that doesn't interest you. That's not how it works. And let me use your your own words against you to make you look like the ultimate political hypocrite. I had a question from Henna on Instagram, and she said, does this mean Scotland will now be going full speed ahead with exiting the UK? Henna, full speed ahead, no. Definitely not going to be seeing this happen in the next few months. Sturgeon made it clear in that same speech and a few times since that pandemic recovery is top of the priority list. Let's deal with that before we start talking about referendums, because they involve a lot of campaigning and she wants to be at her desk dealing with this stuff, which she kind of talked about. However, part of the SNP's promise, its pledge, was that we want a referendum within the parliamentary term. So before the next election. So she's committing to one within the next few years, essentially. And then the question is, can she do that? I had another question on Instagram from Benjamin, who said, can Nicola Sturgeon actually promise a referendum given the reluctance from Boris Johnson? Now, Benjamin, what we have here from yourself is a question that is even confusing the likes of the most geeky and bookish British constitutional experts. Like, I don't know who has the final say here, and I'm not sure anyone really does. And I think that Nicola Sturgeon is going to try and take advantage of that and say, well, the United Kingdom is a voluntary unity of nations, so surely we get to decide. But the Conservatives are going to try and use that in their advantage and say, but you just had a referendum. We can't keep doing this. You're just going to divide up the country. We've got to focus on the pandemic. Stop harassing us about this. So you're going to have these two completely separate ideologies clashing over this very issue. And there's talk of, you know, this could end up in the Supreme Court, with both sides arguing that they're the ones that are right. So the Supreme Court are the ones that need to interpret the Constitution to work out who has the right to do this and who has the right to block it and all the rest of it. So we shall see. Now, you might be wondering, what's Boris Johnson's game plan here? Because I've said what Nicola Sturgeon's ultimate wish is, which is for the Tories to turn around and say, here you go, have a referendum. We support you. Not going to happen. Boris Johnson's ultimate wish is that this just goes away. That's what he wants. He wants this to go away. He doesn't want this conversation. And I think if it were down to him, he would stall the shit out of this until he wasn't in Downing Street anymore. Because no Prime Minister wants Scottish independence on their legacy. He doesn't want his name to be next to, oh, he was in power during the breakup of the Union. That, he doesn't want that on his Wikipedia page. So he's going to try as much as he can not to even get this to a point where it could happen. But I think it's becoming obvious that he's going to have to take action quicker than that, because yes, the Conservatives absolutely nailed the election on a local level. But if you look at the other elections that happened, in Wales, they voted in Labour, and in Scotland, they voted in the SNP, two parties that are firmly planted in opposition to the Conservatives. They don't really overlap. So now Boris Johnson's task is to convince us, the public, that he is the Prime Minister of the UK, not just of England. Because how can you have a mandate, how can you have real legitimate power over a unity of nations if only one of those nations is actually interested in you as a leader? It's not ideal. So what did he do? What has he done? Basically, he started out by putting an olive branch out and saying, let's have a summit for the devolved leaders. Let's get Nicola Sturgeon down. Let's get Mark Drakeford down. I know Arlene Foster, the First Minister of Northern Ireland, is actually stepping down. I don't know who that will be, but let's get them down as well. Whenever we know who's leading Northern Ireland, let's all just chat about how we can enter this next phase of the pandemic recovery together. Let's promote our unity. I think that's his approach. There was a letter that he wrote to Nicola Sturgeon, kind of doing the rounds on Twitter. I'll read you a bit of it if you like. It's dated the 8th of May, 2021. It says, dear Nicola, I write to congratulate you on your success in the Scottish Parliament election in anticipation of your reappointment as First Minister. I believe passionately that the interests of the people across the UK, and in particular the people of Scotland, are best served when we worked together. We have shown that through the vaccine rollout, the UK government's ability to procure vaccines at scale has benefited people in all parts of the country. The dedicated and hardworking staff of NHS Scotland have ensured jabs have been put into the arms from Gretna to John O'Groats. This is Team UK in action. And I recommit the United Kingdom government to working with the Scottish government in this cooperative spirit. So it's very much like, but we love you and we want to stay together and look how good we are together. We could be better than this. Why don't we apply the skills that we've learned through COVID on a wider scale? And he signed it, sincerely, Boris. So not his full name and not all his title and all the rest of it. So it kind of had this casual air of friendship to it in a way. I mean, I'll give you one guess how Nicola Sturgeon's going to respond to that. I imagine disparagingly, because her whole agenda is to get out of the UK. And this approach of love bombing, it's been done before, but we love you, don't leave us. She's going to say, but you said that last time. You said that in 2014 and we still want independence, so you don't love us enough. So yeah, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I don't think she would be offended at what I just said. I think that's the goal, is not to listen to these olive branches and to crack on as planned. I did a whole podcast about Scottish independence as an issue. It's called Scottish Independence, A Big Mistake? It's not me saying that it is. And I can't recommend enough just going to listen to that if you want to hear the arguments on all sides. If you have questions for future episodes, follow me on Instagram at juliabell_x and send me a DM. Do it nicely or I don't reply. And get in touch. What do you make of everything? Because we've talked about a lot of stuff today. I want to hear your viewpoints. Thanks for listening. Make sure you've subscribed to this podcast. If you'd like to keep these episodes going and you want to keep me able to make them, then the best way to do that is to become a patron. I mention it every episode. The link is in the episode description. And I put up loads of bonus content up there every week. And that's it. All right. Thank you. I'll speak to you in the next one. Goodbye.